Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the demonstrations against the regime that have erupted all over Iran and are likely to result in a brutal crackdown by the Supreme Leader's Revolutionary Guards and besieged militia. Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the School of International Studies at the University of Denver and author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, joins us to discuss the explosion of frustration from young Iranians whose rising expectations based on the promise of reform by President Rouhani have been cynically betrayed by a corrupt theocratic regime that cannot reform itself and depends on outside enemies for its legitimacy. We'll examine the expressions of anger by young Iranians at a regime that cares more about the Palestinians and Syria than the future of its own people, and the possibility that Rouhani will be sacrificed by the Supreme Leader, who will unleash more repression and fill the jails even further. Then, with President Trump calling for the Justice Department to prosecute Hillary Clinton's top aide, Huma Abedin, and the former head of the FBI he fired, James Comey, we will assess whether Trump is trying to intimidate or purge not just the FBI but the Justice Department, which the president referred to today in a tweet as, quote, the deep state Justice Department. A former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, Harry Litman, joins us to discuss how dangerous this unprecedented attack on the nonpartisanship and independence of the DOJ and the FBI is, and whether Trump will succeed in his goal of undermining the investigations into him and the Russians. Then finally, we will look into whether North Korea's Kim Jong-un can successfully drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea following his New Year's offering of peace talks to the South Korean president to create a peaceful environment for the Olympics and the 70th anniversary of the founding of North Korea. Scott Snyder, a senior fellow for Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, Kim Jong-un's Trap for South Korea. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
And the demonstrations against the regime in Iran, across Iran, in many cities, not just Tehran, continue, but I think there's a looming crackdown, surely. The IRGC are not going to stand by, and certainly the Supreme Leader, whose pictures, I noticed that the demonstrators were tearing up the posters of the Supreme Leader, and I suppose the person that's most vulnerable and the first to fall would be Rouhani, right? Isn't that likely to happen?
Well, he's caught between a rock and a hard place in the sense that he is a loyal member of the ruling establishment, but at the same time, he has been elected by a relatively large mandate on two occasions based on a platform of improving people's economic conditions and providing for greater personal freedoms and liberties. And so I think part of the problem here that we're seeing in Iran is these huge expectations that were raised by President Rouhani coming into office after 8 years of chronic and colossal mismanagement by the former president, Ahmadinejad, promising to improve the lives of Iranians. He made the argument that if Iran can get its problem with the international community resolved with respect to its nuclear program, if it can get to a nuclear agreement, then things will start to improve. But that's, you know, that was 5 years ago. The nuclear agreement was signed more than 2 years ago. And the economic reality for many Iranians, particularly in the more poorer sections of the country, the smaller towns, villages, the lower economic end of the political spectrum in some of the major cities, their economic condition has not only not improved, it's actually gotten worse. And so I think we're seeing today this broad-based sort of revolt from those segments of Iranian society that are really, you know, deeply frustrated at both the economic and the political conditions. I think these two things are deeply interlinked. It's the corruption, it's the lies, it's the disappointment, and that's fundamentally, I think, the root of this uprising.
But isn't it also the theocracy itself, that you've got this impossible form of government based upon all kinds of ridiculous religious promises and purity, and you've got the Guardians of Revolution, you've got the IRGC, the Basij, this whole theocratic structure that's oppressed the people, just as the Wahhabis and the royal... I mean, that's the thing that bothers me so much, is that the both Iran and Saudi Arabia are involved in all these proxy wars that are just causing so much misery from Syria to Yemen. And they're very similar in a way. They've got completely corrupt, illegitimate regimes based upon exaggerated religiosity, and they oppress their people using religion. And now you've got two spoiled brats on the way up. You've got this, the son of the ailing king in Saudi Arabia, throwing his weight around, doesn't know what he's doing. And then you've got this other possibility that the son of the supreme leader could take over in Iran. But to my mind, there's a sort of mirror there, even though these two, Saudi Arabia and Iran, are so at loggerheads and there's such hostility, there's also a lot of similarity.
I would agree with that description, Ian. Yes, I think fundamentally what we're seeing today, both in Iran and in Saudi Arabia, are the predictable consequences that flow from authoritarian political systems. Now, both Iran and Saudi Arabia are authoritarian political systems, but their authoritarian political systems differ in significant ways. But at the end of the day, authoritarian repressive political systems, both of which are actually quite... they have a lot of financial resources at their disposal, are spending those resources not to satisfy the legitimate needs of their people, but they're spending it fundamentally to preserve and perpetuate the political rule of the ruling elites that are in power. In the case of Iran, what's interesting in these recent protests is the explicit linking between Iran's foreign policy adventurism in the Middle East, in Syria in particular, in Lebanon, in Palestine to a certain extent, people openly stating on the streets of Tehran that stop intervening in Syria, think of our own internal political and economic situation. That is in many ways, I think, a quite revealing, I think, repudiation of the legitimacy of the ruling clerical establishment that up until recently thought that it had won a successful war in Syria and that most of its population within Iran supported Iran's policy. We're now seeing that people are repudiating the regional foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they don't understand why so many billions of dollars, we don't know the entire figure, we don't know the true amount of how much Iran has spent in Syria, in Lebanon, and in other places, because these figures are not publicly discussed and they're not accountable, which highlights the point that you were making, Ian, that this is an authoritarian political system where there is not transparency, and it's the ruling elites who make the fundamental decisions in terms of how resources are expended. And the population has to bear the brunt of those decisions, and they really have no fundamental voice. This is, I think, a big part of the problem. And we're seeing, you know, these linkages playing themselves out in dozens of cities across Iran today.
And indeed, a lot of the demonstrators were shouting, stop helping Palestine and start helping us. So it's pretty clear.
Yeah, it's pretty clear. It's also, you know, because this is a revolutionary state, it claims to be a revolutionary state, and it brags and it claims that it's, you know, the voice of the oppressed Muslim masses. And so it makes a big claim of, you know, investing in these conflicts. But of course, Iran has its own internal economic and political crises that seem not to be addressed. And there's no ability. I mean, in the case of, let's say, Syria today, it is a red line, a regime's red line for anyone to stand up and publicly criticize Iranian foreign policy in Syria. Every time someone has done so, even in a mild form, they are immediately repressed. And so this highlights, I think, this fundamental crisis of legitimacy that the Islamic Republic of Iran is facing. It thought that it could, it thought that it had the command and the support of most of its population. But as we're seeing today over the last 6 days, that's not the case.
But given that Rouhani is a part of the establishment, the clerical establishment led by Khamenei, the supreme leader, who's basically is the realization of God's will on earth. That's how he claims his legitimacy. So this is an extraordinary theocracy. But Rouhani, since you wrote about the Green Movement in The People Reloaded, the Green Movement and the struggle for Iran's future, going back to the Green Revolt of 2009, Rouhani was one of the people who repressed the students, and they were shot. And today, we don't even know, if the kids are being shot as we speak. I mean, I think it's pretty much inevitable, isn't it? The IRGC and the Basijis are going to come in and crack heads, if not shoot people.
Yeah, I think as this continues on, and now we're into day six, this is becoming now a major crisis for the Islamic Republic. Yesterday, I saw reports that the security for the major cities, in particular Tehran, is now being taken over by the regime's more loyal troops, taking out of the hands of the local police and into the hands of the Revolutionary Guard and the besieged militia. So this crackdown is underway as we speak. You can see it in the form of the attempt to slow down or block social media access. You can start to see it in the large number of deaths that we're seeing overnight. The number of people who died doubled, and I think that's a reflection of the crackdown that's taking place. And at the end of the day, the Islamic Republic, despite its attempts to claim that it has the support of the people and that it has regular elections, at the core of the Islamic Republic, it is a police state. Its apparatus of repression, its ability to regulate people's lives, and its ability to crush dissent, is quite extensive and it's quite vast. Iran's jails are filled with opposition activists. And now I think those jails are going to be filled even more now with protesters, mostly just young kids in their 20s living in poor sections of the country who have lost hope over the policies and over the course of the Islamic Republic, the course it has been taking. And now they're in many ways in open revolt. And so this is going to simply perpetuate, I think, this crisis of legitimacy that the Islamic Republic was facing. In many ways, Ian, you mentioned the Green Movement revolt in 2009. That was broadly an urban-based revolt. It was a middle-class revolt. It mostly took place in the major cities, Tehran in particular. What we're seeing today is something qualitatively different in the nature of revolt. This is a broad-based, geographically spread revolt taking place in towns and villages outside of the major urban centers and among the poor segments of society, people who previously, were not part of the Green Movement, but now in many ways they've revolted, and they revolted with a lot of anger and a raw cry of desperation that the current status quo is untenable for them. If ever these two movements, the one that's currently underway as we speak and the urban-based Green Movement revolt, which was repressed in 2009, if they ever coalesce, then the Islamic Republic of Iran is in dire trouble.
But when we talk about Rouhani as a moderate, and I'm guilty of doing that myself, I wonder how much we're being conned in trying to see a sort of, a moderate face of that same regime. It seems to me that it's all been pretty cynical, that Ahmadinejad was just an embarrassment, and he was such a crazy religious true believer, a twelfther, if you want to explain that to the audience. But can you do that briefly?
Well, he was a hardline extreme, populist / fundamentalist. He campaigned on a slogan of populism, not that different than what we're seeing around the world today, right? Redistribution of resources, going back to the, he was in many ways sort of, invoking what Donald Trump is saying today. He was saying, let's make Iran great again. Let's go back to the early revolutionary days. Let's distribute the wealth. Let's attack these ruling elites who've been in power since 1979. And, when it was to his advantage, he would invoke these religious, causes and themes. But I think fundamentally he was driven by a particular power dynamic of self-aggrandizement and these delusions of grandeur that he was really suffering from. He would travel abroad and he would get massive media attention, and it went to his head, not realizing that power inside Iran is in the office of the supreme leader. And when the two had a falling out, he quickly fell from power. And now, if people are interested, the recent developments is now there's a major intra-hardliner battle between Ahmadinejad and his hardline former supporters who've now sort of, have condemned him for being mentally ill and for being a subversive and on the payroll of, external powers. So he was one of these maverick politicians who were supported by the hardline establishment, they utilized him to the extent that he was beneficial to them, and once he wasn't, he was cast aside. So I think that was the fundamental, I think, dynamic. With respect to the theme that you bring up, Ian, Rouhani, and to what extent is he a moderate voice or not, I think fundamentally, he is in terms of his at least stated positions. But I think one has to situate Rouhani within the structure of power that he operates. His ability to bring about change is limited by virtue of the fact that he's working within the Islamic Republic of Iran's political system, where power is fundamentally allocated in the office of the supreme leader and in those institutions of the state, particularly the security forces and particularly the judiciary, that are controlled by hardline forces, of which Rouhani has no control over. So in terms of his rhetoric, in order to get elected, he's been forced to give speeches and make statements where the votes are located, that is, where young people are. In other words, he's made statements and he's made promises to line up with the aspirations of young people and the aspirations of those people who, want political change. And so that's characterized his, his two elections, the two presidential elections that he ran for. Now that he is in this moment of crisis, he's making more statements. I mean, his statement on Sunday night, in his first response to the protest, was he was acknowledging their legitimate grievances. He was acknowledging their right to protest, but sort of trying to strike a tone in the direction of hardliners, Iran's supreme leader, saying, we understand that our enemies are also gathering and they're trying to infiltrate us. So he, in many ways, is a lame duck president in the sense that his power to effect change and to deliver on the promises that he has made is severely limited by virtue of the structure of power in which he operates. And so I think he does have the ability. This would be an interesting test. He does have the ability to do something that I think would really shake up Iranian politics in a healthy way. He has the ability of handing in his resignation and saying, I made these promises, I've been unable to deliver, I'm stepping down. I doubt he will do that, because my reading of him is he's fundamentally a creature of the Islamic ruling establishment. I don't think he would want to shake up the system that in many ways produced him. So I don't think he will go in that direction, although the option theoretically is there for him to take such a step.
But the broader issue is that the regime entirely relies upon paranoia about outside enemies and death to the great Satan and all that stuff that they've been doing forever. And it's not like North Korea, but it's the same kind of external threat in order to cover up a internal kleptocracy. So, my sense is that Rouhani failed because he made these promises. Whether he was cynical or not, whether he believed them or not, I think's beside the point. I mean, this regime cannot afford to open up to the rest of the world, even though that's what the young people want. And, the idea that they need foreign investment. Well, no businessman from the West is going to go in there and be subject to arrest by the IRGC, which is how the regime operates. So, even on the one hand, where they show some fig leaf of moderation, but on the other hand, they also crack down. So isn't that at the heart of it? This is a regime that simply can't allow its people to get closer to the rest of the world. It has to be in that kind of, religious bubble along with its revolutionary pretenses of helping the Syrians, meddling in Iraq, etc. And as you pointed out earlier, God knows how much money that's cost the Iranian people, and God knows how much money it would cost if Iran and Russia were forced to reconstruct Syria.
No, yeah, I think I would agree with your characterization. I think fundamentally, the hardline ruling establishment that effectively runs the country, has veto decision on everything, is unwilling and unable to open up to the rest of the world, to change its foreign policy orientation internationally. And also, this ruling clerical establishment is unable and unwilling to change its policies internally, because doing so effectively would result in their demise. It would be the weakening of their power and the coming to power of more accountable and democratically elected leaders. And so, like other authoritarian regimes, as you just indicated, they play from the dictator's handbook. Whenever there's a crisis, they don't blame it on their own internal incompetency and their own corrupt and incompetent policies. They invoke the specter of foreign enemies and foreign threats, and they try to exacerbate and exploit long-standing fears and historical memories, which are very legitimate in the context of many Middle Eastern countries, in particular Iran, that was subjected to, you know, interference by great powers. But they try and exploit those, you know, claims and fears as a way of holding on to their own power. This is something that we have seen in among all dictators. You mentioned North Korea. I recall distinctly during the Arab Spring when these revolutions were breaking out, all of these authoritarian regimes claimed that these protests were being inspired by foreign agitators. So nothing new here. And so we're seeing this play out in the context of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I would just qualify what you said, Ian, by noting that there are deep and significant factional differences within Iran among the clerical elite. I think the faction that supported Rouhani, those people who claim to be reformists, do believe in a different set of policies internationally, and they do believe in a different set of policies internally. The problem is that they don't have the political power or the authority to bring about those policies because they hit a brick wall, a wall that is controlled and manned by the hardline clerical establishment that refuses to concede any ground and refuses to acquiesce to the democratic wishes of the vast majority of Iranians. And sure. So the story continues.
And they're the guys with the guns.
They're the guys with the guns, and they're the guys who, you know, these are not people, you know, if they lose power, they're going to get on a plane and go to the south of France.
Right.
You know, they've got nowhere to go. They're there to fight to the finish. And, of course, they'll invoke religious, I think, theology to maintain support and perpetuate their political rule. I think that argument increasingly is actually less effective in Iran. What you do see the hardliners doing is invoking the theme of nationalism. We are the protectors of Iran's sovereignty. We are the ones who are standing up for Iran's integrity against outside enemies. And so that's the card that they've been playing increasingly over the last few years.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's tweet today about the deep state Justice Department and his efforts to purge the DOJ and the FBI.